It's Tyre Power's Big Footy Final Sale. To kick things off, you can get the power to buy three and get one free on selected Toyo passenger car and SUV tyres. Tyre Power's Big Footy Final Sale can't last. Visit tyrepower.com.au now.
For logbook servicing you can rely on, you need to make the right choice. You need trained professionals who are fully qualified to service your car according to manufacturer's specifications. For real peace of mind and a nationwide warranty, book in or book online at repcoservice.com.
Big talk, big opinions, the panel. Talk to me,
yeah. Joining us on the panel today, Sackerman, Sam Ackerman, how are you, sir?
Yeah, very well, mate, very well.
That's the story. And David Long from stuff.co.nz. How are you, David?
Yeah, good, thanks, Ricardo. Hi, Sam.
Now, gentlemen, Mike Hessen has written a story. He believes that shifting Kane Williamson down the T20 batting order could be a game changer for him. I don't know if that works. For me, Kane takes too long to get going, so down the order when you've got less time, less balls left, doesn't make much sense to me. But Hessen probably knows a bit more about cricket than I do, Sam. What do you make of this?
Oh, I completely agree. Hessen knows a lot more about cricket than you do, Ricardo. So we'll start with that as an underlined fact. And look, the fact of the matter is, I'm really surprised it doesn't happen more in cricket, to be perfectly honest, is I think that in a game like T20, it should be a horses for courses approach. If the flow's going nicely, or depending on who goes out from the Allen and Conway combo, I like the idea of saying, do you know what? Actually, we don't want to have Devon and Kane in the early trying to plod through. We still need someone to go for the jugular here. So let's get Glenn Phillips up there, or let's do that. It's, you know, you think of the night watchman situation or a pinch hitter when it's needed. There needs to be more movement. And yes, Kane Williamson demands respect for who he is, what he's done and everything. We can't deny that his form hasn't been short of what his best can be. We saw a decent knock in the recent T20s with India, but he's a guy who needs to be given the right opportunity. I like the idea of Kane Williamson being there at the end of a run chase. He's cool, he's composed, and can get things done. We've seen him do it nicely in the 50 over game, so I'm not opposed to it. And you're right, he does take a while to warm up, but in that context, it's a bit, you know, you can grow as big as your fishbowl. If he doesn't have much time, he's not going to suddenly start leaving balls outside off and plotting singles. If he needs to push in, he will. He's a quality of cricketer that we really see anywhere in the world, let alone this country. So finding a way to make him more useful is a good idea.
Yeah, all right. What about you, David? I mean, one of the reasons that I didn't think it would work was, I'm trying to remember the game here, I think it might have been the Pakistan semi-final in the latest T20 World Cup, is we had 35 dot balls in that game and 14 of them were eaten up by Kane getting going. What do you make of what Hessen said?
Yeah, well, I sort of understand where he's coming from, and I think if it was a 50-over game, you can certainly buy into that, because when you want to score a lot of runs early on and then establish some innings, some run, and then a big run chase towards the end. But in a 20-over game, you've got to go out right from the beginning, really. And the way Kane's batting, as you mentioned, it's not good enough to be fielded by caps, and they're always struggling in run chases or getting runs on the board because Kane's taking too long to get going. I mean, yeah, I know he's been fantastic and he's one of New Zealand's greatest ever cricketers, but I don't think you can pick him in a T20 team at the moment until he needs to prove himself or whatever form of cricket, 2020 cricket, he's going to be playing. I don't know if he's going to get an IPL contract and he's been dumped from that team. But until he does prove himself that he can score runs quickly again, I don't think he's going to be playing for the Black Caps in the T20s.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a certainly split opinion, particularly with the treatment of Martin Gupta lad, Mark O'Donnell, on the former Auckland Aces coach. He's coached Jamaica in the CPL as well, Sam, and he suggested that potentially Martin Gupta could have been the answer because he's a guy with the experience he's got, that he can play the glue role or he can play the hitting role, and maybe it should have been him, should have been Kane rather than him that was let go out of the T20 side.
Yeah, just it's important to take a step back here and understand who Kane Williamson is and what he is to this team across the formats. To drop Kane Williamson, the captain and the man considered by a lot of good judges, one of, if not the best, batsmen this country's produced, to drop him from the not just the captaincy, but the team altogether. What does that mean for the rest of the teams? It's slightly destabilising, I think. I don't think it's the move to make. I think what has to happen is Kane Williamson needs to decide whether he wants to play. And I don't believe in dropping Kane Williamson because you need to retain a little bit of experience, you need to retain a little bit of class. You can't pick a team like the Black Caps purely on, oh, well, they've got a bit of form under their belt right now. Not purely. It sounds unusual because form should be the overriding factor. But you can't get rid of all the experience. You can't lose the Trent Bolts. You can't lose the Martin Guptills. And that top order becomes really exposed and once they need to find those tools to dig deep. The reason these players like the Williamsons, the Guptills, have been successful is because they've had gone through those lean Black Caps times as well. And the reason that these players coming through have done well is they've been supported by an extremely talented and experienced core of players and batsmen around them. So there has to be a middle ground there. But I agree with what David says. On form, very hard to pick him. But I also, I'd like to think that Kane Williamson's in a few more reps than that.
Yeah, all right. Let's talk supercars. David, I know this is right up your alley. You're at Bathurst again this year. New Zealand nowhere on the 2023 calendar. Is 2024 realistic, given that when we lost Pukki, they said it wasn't going to be an issue?
Well, supercars are saying that they're very hopeful of getting something sorted for 2024. There's not going to be a racetrack that ticks every box that's going to miraculously appear somewhere in New Zealand between over the next 12 months. So the issue is still going to be there. Hampton Downs has obviously been talked about as the most likely option, but there are significant issues with Hampton Downs given its small size, the lack of facilities and the proximity to the Auckland Motorway, the State Highway 1, which is grind to a halt for the 3 days of supercars there. So there's talk about other tracks as well. It's interesting that Auckland Unlimited, and their statement about it, they said, we'd like to see it back inside Auckland. Which the only sort of conclusion you can get from that is that the possibility of a street race through Auckland, which has been sort of looked at before and then passed over as being too expensive or too much of a headache to put together. Whether that's the option, I mean, the Auckland street race, you know, does satisfy a lot of the needs in terms of having it in the inside the biggest population and the infrastructure that is here. But obviously, street races aren't cheap and takes a lot of time to get organised. I really don't know what the solution is or where it might go, but I do worry, you know, what the future is for supercars in New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I know what you're talking about there with Auckland Unlimited. Sort of it needs to be within Auckland boundaries is what they're saying for them to invest in it. But Sam, I mean, if they're going to be racing at Hampton Downs, it's kind of halfway between Hamilton and Auckland. Surely most of the supercars teams are going to be based in Auckland anyway, so there's still going to be financial gain for Auckland.
Yes, there is, they will have. Hampton Downs is, anyone who's been there knows it's a great spot to watch motor racing. They've got a decent setup there, and I don't think that it's a lay-down nazir that they're capable of handling everything that the supercars circus brings with it. But you can't blame Auckland Unlimited from saying if we're going to fund it or we're going to support it, rather, we want it to be in somewhere that it can pay off for us. Maybe it's a joint deal with Hamilton Council, but it's hard enough to get one council to sign off on something, let alone two. So let's not get ahead of ourselves. And street race, I had to put the phone away from my mouth as I laughed out loud when Dave said the word street race, because those of us who lived through the experience of the last, hey, how about a street race, and the amount of red tape. I think they imported red tape from overseas because they ran out of how much red tape they had to drown that thing in Auckland. It was one of the great debacles, and much like a waterfront stadium, great idea until somebody weighs in and anchors the bad boy down. A street race in Auckland would be fantastic. I mean, it's not like anything else happens down in that downtown area most of the time anyway. So let's make it happen. Fantastic. But it would be fantastic.
We'll just do the street race in Papamoa. Perfect. Down your end, Sam. You can host it.
We've got plenty of space. Bring it to the bay. There's no dramas there. I mean, I hope you'll like really thin roads and potholes. But besides that, we've got you covered.
Good stuff. Sounds like the rest of New Zealand.
Big talk, big opinions, the panel. Talk, talk, talk to me, yeah.
Stuff's David Long and Sam Ackerman with us on the panel. Gentlemen, the FIFA World Cup has been going on, and as you can both imagine, it's taken up a lot of my time. Interesting that this morning, Breel Embolo, the Switzerland striker, was born in Cameroon, played against them today, and scored against him in a 1-0 win for the Swiss. He's then apologized. He didn't celebrate, and then refused. He refused to celebrate, and then apologized for scoring against them. It's a tough one. I'd imagine, David. I can't imagine that you'd do the same though. If you scored against the Welsh for New Zealand, would you be doing the same?
That's a good one. I mean, it was quite trendy, wasn't it, in English football a few years ago that you didn't celebrate when you scored a goal against your old club. That seems to have gone a bit now, I think, in recent years. But, I'd be disappointed if I was a supporter of the team he's playing for and it happened. Who's he supporting? You're playing for the team you're wearing the shirt for. And if you didn't want to score against your nation you were born in, then don't play in that game. It just seems pretty crazy to me.
Yeah, it does. I don't know about you, Sam. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Maybe Tony Carroll. I mean, Tony Carroll played for the Kangaroos, then the Kiwis, then went back to the Kangaroos. What would he do?
They just smash anyone, including referees, that got in his way. I don't think he didn't have. But listen, David. He didn't not want to score the goal. He just didn't want to rub it in the nose of somebody. It's called being a class act. And I know people who follow football don't see that very often. But it's when you are just a good human being and you don't feel the need to rub every one of your successes in someone else's face. Sometimes you just take a humble road. But Ricardo, I don't know about you, mate. I'm World Cupped out. You know, we had the cricket, T20. We had the two league World Cups, the Women's Rugby World Cup. I'm kind of done. I might sit this one out, actually. You know, let's the Football World Cup. You know, New Zealand's not even in it. I mean, who cares?
Well, that's a hard take, Sam, because for me, this is the World Cup. Everything else is secondary, really. I mean, football did it first.
What a surprise, Ricardo. I definitely wasn't throwing a bit of bait out there for you at all, mate.
Jeez. Sam.
I wouldn't have thought that. I'm surprised, should I say, by the headlines. I think this is created with this, the apologising for scoring. I don't think he was like on his knees crying, begging forgiveness. He was just saying he didn't want to inflict. He's got pride in two nationalities. He didn't want to inflict anything that hurt on others. And given the hardline stances on so many things with this World Cup, and sport fans have got a lot to enjoy, and those who like to delve into the politics of the world have even more to tuck into with this World Cup. So I'm all for class acts. So like the Japanese, after winning their incredible match victory against Germany, cleaning up, I know they've done it before, but it's such a great thing. They tidy up their own dressing rooms, make origami paper cranes, and leave a thank you note. Now, class acts, those are cool stories to hear out of this.
Yeah, they are. You're right. And, there's no end, David, obviously, of political statements and things around this World Cup, given where it is and who is hosting it and all of the background to that. One of the ones that has interested me is the criticism that David Beckham has come in for. He's an ambassador for Qatar for this World Cup. He took $10 million to be an ambassador. He's filmed a whole bunch of little videos and things. And Joe Lycett, who's an English comedian, has taken exception to this because, obviously, of the LGBT community and the way that the Qatari laws are around that. He said that David Beckham was, really a gay icon. He was the first straight man to be on a lot of the gay covers of gay magazines. He said he did the most gay thing possible in marrying a Spice Girl, and he's always been one of those that's seemed to have been open and supportive of that community. He basically got £10,000, filmed himself and said, if you have a week, David, to use that $10 million to do something good for the LGBT community or to come out and criticise Qatar for the way that they persecute people in this, otherwise I'm going to shred this £10,000 along with any credibility you have. What did you make of that and David Beckham's resulting silence?
Well, it was a great publicity stunt from Joe Lycett. He did admit afterwards that it might have been £10,000 that looked like it was going in the shredder, but it was fake money that was coming out of it, and he's donated that money to charities for support of the LGBT communities. But I think it's he did highlight the hypocrisy of what David Beckham's doing, and then videos that he's doing now, you know, promoting Qatar and saying what a great place it is, and that things can change because of the World Cup. Well, you know, he's only doing this because he's getting his back pocket filled by saying this sort of stuff. I think if you look at David Beckham, you know, a few months ago in Britain, he was being hailed and his reputation went through the roof because he joined the queue to see the Queen's coffin rather than push to the front using his status. But I think people have lost a lot of respect for him because he's doing this. And another thing you're hearing a lot lately, I guess you know you listen to the podcast or read about it as well, Ricardo, is that people are criticising journalists for saying how can you have a go at the World Cup when you're going over there and you're on holiday and you're just doing just the same as what David Beckham's doing. But there's a big difference between going to cover something as a journalist or reporter to doing over there where you're just taking money straight from the Qataris. This is what David Beckham's doing.
Yeah, he certainly opened himself up to a lot of criticism on that. All right, let's finish, gentlemen, with some oval ball and news yesterday or the day before that Carlos Spencer is back in the Blues as the backs coach for the Super Rugby Aupiki team. Great to have the king back, as the PR release said. Sam, what do you make of the move from a Blues point of view?
I think everybody in New Zealand rugby or who supports rugby in New Zealand knows that Carlos Spencer at Auckland is a natural fit. It feels right. When you hear he's coaching somebody else, it's one of those players you can go, it doesn't quite feel like he's in the right place. And him being back with Auckland is great. And being part of Aupiki is fantastic as well. Not that, you know, these women have shown over the past few months how capable they are of doing their own thing. But we should point out that they delved into a lot of great rugby experience. Some of that happened to be female, some of it happened to be male to achieve that success. And what Carlos Spencer brings is a lot of rugby now experience and a willingness to try things. No one can ever accuse Carlos Spencer of playing it safe through his rugby career. So having somebody like that who's prepared to, you know, give them a bit of license and the ability to show the natural skills that we all know that women rugby players in this country have, it's wonderful to see, and a great association renewed.
Yeah, it is good to see. And David, I guess the other thing, Ruahi Dumont working with Carlos Spencer, is that makes me excited for the next Super Rugby Aupiki season from a Blues point of view. And it's also going to, I would imagine, give it a few more headlines and get a few more eyeballs on it with his involvement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at it on face value, it's fantastic for the Blues team to have someone like Carlos working there. I think, you know, Carlos has sort of been involved in coaching teams in South Africa and in places previously. And I think assistant coach, this sort of role, it does seem to be more sort of suited to Carlos rather than, can't you ever see him being a head coach of a team. I don't think he's got that sort of, personality or drive to sort of take that responsibility on. But in terms of like coaching and what he can bring to players and team, I think it's fantastic. I mean, the other sort of side of it is that, and this is nothing against Carlos or the Blues, I guess, in some way, is that, you know, I would like to sort of see more women being coached in these Super Rugby Aupiki teams. We're still seeing it very much dominated by men. We'd like to get to a position where, you know, you could get a woman coaching a Super Rugby men's team, or it doesn't matter what sex you are, but I guess there's an issue, but, you know, I would like to see more pathways or whatever to see women coaching at these Super Rugby teams.
I think we've got two this year, which is two more than we had last year, because I don't think there were any female head coaches last year. But I think, New Zealand Rugby has made a move in that direction. They kind of had to, because in a way, David, they got made to look bad, because then the Phoenix announced their women's team and had, you know, an all-female coaching staff.
Yeah, that's right. And you look at the NRLW as well, which is dominated by men's coaches. I think it's a missing piece of the jigsaw in terms of, you know, the rise of women's sport that we're seeing is that it is still heavily dominated by men. And, you know, it's great that there was a couple of women this year, and we saw some women involved in the Black Ferns as well during this World Cup campaign. But, hopefully it continues in that direction.
Yeah. And gentlemen, thanks very much for your time on the panel today. Really appreciate it. Go well and have great weekends.
Thanks a lot.
See you, mate. See you, Dave.
Deck maintenance isn't fun. Move the furniture and barbecue, sand and prep, paint, seal, or get a low-maintenance Trex deck. The only colour fade you'll have to deal with is watching the sunset. Trex, the world's number one decking brand.